CliffCentral.com.
All right, it is time for us to get into Democracy 101. We're going to check out what's going on in this important part of our week, where we also catch up with all the things that are happening ahead of the elections. And I think a lot of people are particularly concerned about where to get their news. So, since we've already kind of opened the subject for discussion in the first hour of this morning's show, thought it was probably appropriate and a good idea to get someone in who can help us understand and navigate our way through some very complicated waters. Camilla Barth is a seasoned journalist, news editor, consultant, and trainer. She's got more than 20 years of experience in global news and the media landscape around it. She's also a board member of the World Press Institute. Currently, she spearheads diverse training initiatives for journalists worldwide, particularly in Africa and Europe, focuses on AI integration, which is all the rage at the moment. Also, broadcast journalism, fact-checking, and that's a whole controversial thing all on its own. Mm-hmm. She's an accomplished broadcaster herself. She's anchored primetime radio and news bulletins for EWN on 702. Also contributed gratefully and significantly to the establishment of the TV news channel Newsroom Africa. So it is a great pleasure to have Camilla Barth on the show this morning. Hey, Camilla, how are you?
Good morning, Gareth. I'm very well, thanks. How are you doing?
Good morning, Camilla.
Yeah, nice.
Good morning, Jack.
Jack and I are very excited to have you on because as part of Democracy 101, we're sort of giving ourselves and everybody who's joining us on this journey a bit of a crash course in the basics around how, you know, democracy, politics in general, elections, educating yourself to make sure that you're not bamboozled by politicians, all of that stuff. We're trying to package it in a way that'll help people to make sense of the world. It sometimes feels like nothing makes sense. And especially, I think, in a world where we are worried about the sources of our news, we're worried about whether something is true or not. And there are so many people out there just vying for our attention, billboards blasting at us every 5 seconds from our devices all over the world. There are campaigns which are being financed by interest groups. We cannot get away from advertising. We cannot get away from political messaging. And frankly, the news has become a subject of contention, which maybe it never was before, or maybe we were just naive enough to believe it never was before. But it's hard to find out what's true these days, right?
Absolutely, Gareth. And, you know, I think the main challenge that we're dealing with at the moment is almost a surplus of information. And the real issue there is that you have both true and false information mingling and mixing and coming at you at a million miles an hour, right? So I always talk about the sort of information cycle at the moment. The news cycle that we always used to be used to was either, if you were in print, maybe a weekly cycle. In broadcast, in TV news, it would have been a daily cycle. You had one news bulletin a day. In radio, maybe it was an hourly cycle, and that felt really fast. But these days, what we're dealing with really is, I think, what's called a news cyclone rather than a news cycle, right? There is 24-hour, 365 publishing. We have information coming at us literally like a fire hose. If you just imagine standing in front of an enormous fire hose that's gushing water in your face, right? You're never going to be able to take a meaningful sip of that water. And you might well die of dehydration just standing in front of that fire hose because it's coming at you so fast. And so my idea around what media and journalism is here for these days is actually rather than trying to add to that fire hose and just spit out more and more and more information, is there a way that we can channel some of that water off to one side and say, here, audience, this is what you need to drink. Take a sip from this and you'll be perfectly hydrated. And I think the role of media as a result of this sort of information overload that we have is changing. And people don't trust the news as much as they used to. It's a fact around the world. And we need to be aware of it.
I mean, part of that is also the news's fault, right?
Absolutely.
It's the news's fault because so many news organizations have prostituted themselves to whoever has the money or whoever's politically powerful. And we're not talking about South Africa necessarily, but all over the world we see this. And the news organizations that we used to trust in inverted commas, also have become echo chambers and have become partisan and give us the info that we want rather than the info that is true.
Yeah, so I mean, I think there are a couple of things going on there. Number one, you know, the barrier to entry for publishing and for being a news voice has dropped so much in the last few years as a result of increased digitalization, right? You're seeing a plethora of news sources or people portraying themselves as credible news sources who perhaps aren't respectful of or bound by the principles of journalism as we understand it from inside the craft, as it were. So you do have this mingling of voices. You do have as well the financial imperative that's been coming into the newsroom increasingly, certainly in the 21, 22 odd years that I've been in the news, if you will. I have seen a marked shift of this financial imperative. Newsrooms are being forced to talk about money in ways that we never had to before because the advertising model is failing. We haven't yet found a better model to replace that. You know, everyone's trying a bit of everything, but many newsrooms are really struggling financially. And as a result of that, we have this conversation that is now happening about clicks or views or viewer numbers and this pressure on journalists to keep those in mind. And, you know, you're breaking down that Chinese wall between editorial and sales as a result of that. And I think people are then, or there is a space perhaps that's being opened up for more partisan coverage or more sensationalist coverage, because there's that drive, that added drive to get eyeballs on sites to ensure that things are sustainable. And that really starts to undermine the reason for being for journalism, as I'd call it. To me, journalism really should and does boil down to one simple thing, and that's helping people make better choices in their lives. That's what journalism is for. We are advocates for our audience, and our main role really is to try and help people make better decisions. We don't report on a traffic accident because we want them to rubberneck. We report on a traffic accident because we want them to perhaps be able to make a different choice about which route they take to work. We don't report on elections because we support a particular party or are pushing a certain agenda. We report on them in order to equip people with the information that they need to make a better choice at the polls. And that cornerstone of journalism, that kernel of journalism, sometimes is being eroded now as we see the financial imperative start to become more prevalent in our newsrooms.
But, you know, Camilla, truth be told, as much as you have that imperative as journalists, you still have lives to live, right? You still have to pay your own bills. You still have to drive to work. You're going to have to somehow travel between one place and the other. How do you go about finding the balance between communicating or at least taking your imperative seriously to inform the public, but at the same time keeping a close eye on the fact that you have to get these views in order to generate some sort of an income?
Yeah, I mean that's the tough question, and you know, Jack, if I had an answer to that, I think I'd be a multi-trillionaire by now, right?
Yeah.
My net worth would be bigger than the South African GDP. Unfortunately, you use the word balance there, and I think really it is a balance that we need to strike. It's difficult to ignore the commercial interests, and it's difficult to, and I think it would be foolhardy to pretend that those don't come to bear. But I think the real trick in a way for journalists is to be aware of those things, to be aware of how they might impact us or influence the way we might behave, and then to actively fight against that. There's no better solution to me than that. When the reality is that we need to put food on the table, absolutely, but we have a duty to our audiences. And as long as we keep them central, I really do think that we are able then to make better decisions than not.
So Camilla, the elections are coming up, and obviously political parties, by hook or by crook, try to get coverage. They try to get exposure because for them, that's very valuable. It'll maybe persuade a few voters. We're entering probably the most important election that we've had in this country since 1994. There are a lot of people contesting it. There are many different interests in how this election will pan out. Many of us are pinning a lot of hopes on it. How do journalists go about trying to safeguard the news from politicians who are trying to propagandize everything and from an audience that probably is already kind of bored with politics and saturated with political messaging? How do you keep it interesting without making it trivial and silly? And how do you keep the politicians at bay? Because that's a huge problem, is the way that they try to inveigle themselves into news stories by saying something controversial. We know how many lazy journalists there are who just use Twitter as a source for things. So they go and they find something that they know is clickbait, and it's going to get the views that they're under the pressure to get for the business of the newsroom to work. And then they'll report on whatever's the most controversial, the most attention getting, the most clickbaity, even if it isn't the most valuable information.
Yeah, so I mean, I think those are two separate issues in some ways. So let's deal with the politicians first. And of course, we're going to see increased rhetoric leading up to the elections. You're going to see inflammatory opinions. You're going to see politicians really doing whatever they can to get into the news cycle. And sadly, as we all know, what really sells is outrage. And so many politicians are going to start speaking in very inflamed language, and they are going to start trying to provoke outrage or other strong emotions in people and in journalists, because that's what guarantees them news coverage. And I think right from the beginning of a news cycle, certainly in all the elections that I've covered over the years, the real key is firstly strong editorial leadership from the beginning, strong editorial decision making around what we will cover, what we won't cover, strong ideas around balance and equity. I mean, by law, in an election cycle, newsrooms are required to give equitable coverage and balanced coverage to political parties. So we do need to reflect diverse views. We do need to make sure that we are giving airtime appropriately to different organizations. That doesn't mean equal airtime, though. So in terms of if you think, for instance, of the ANC, which the opinion polls will tell us at the moment might get somewhere between 40% and 50% of the vote in these elections, whether that's going to be higher or lower, we really can't say for sure. But you know, a party as significant and heavyweight as the ANC, as we all know, will get significantly more coverage and airtime than, for instance, a one-man band who is perhaps lucky enough to get 20,000 votes. Do you know what I mean? So we can't dedicate the same amount of airtime or the same amount of print space to the tiniest of parties as that we do to the largest of parties. So we do have to be quite judicial in that, if I can put it like that. We have to keep balance and equity in mind, but then also be sure to be, again, being advocates for our audience. We have to ensure that our audiences are getting the information that's going to be most useful to them. So it's a balancing act that one has to strike. And I think it's also important as journalists, you know, often what we leave out is as important as what we include in our news bulletins, and sometimes more so. And so there are certain decisions that one has to make about politicians who've perhaps crossed a line into hate speech or into some form of mis or disinformation. And we need to actively work against that and keep that out of the news cycle. Firstly, because it's law, we can't publish hate speech, for instance, but also because we want to responsibly use the position that we have to curate information for people and to make sure that they're hearing the valuable information rather than just whatever is put in front of us. That's he said.
Yeah, but then who determines what is the valuable information and who determines what is mis or disinformation? We've seen a lot of controversy in America around what was considered mis and disinformation when it came to COVID. Mm-hmm. A lot of what ended up being true was branded as mis- and disinformation by the powers that be, the people who supposedly know better than the rest of us. Turns out that they were completely wrong. They were deliberately misleading people, which is misinformation, disinformation, that was coming from the supposedly trusted sources. And the rest of the people who had a different point of view were demonized and sidelined and very often on social media banned outright for having a different point of view. So how can we trust these editors and these people who once held a position of prominence and of credibility in society when they've let themselves and the rest of us down so badly?
Yeah, well, Gareth, once again, if I had the answer to that question, I would be the happiest person in the world. The issue of trust in journalism is enormous at the moment. It can't be overstated. Around the world, we are seeing audiences losing trust in news organizations, either because they are starting to see behind the curtain and realize that we're just humans, just like everyone else, or they are starting to see in the less scrupulous newsrooms that they are being actively manipulated or misled. And the trust issue is one of the biggest factors, to my mind, in this election year, not only here in South Africa, but around the world. I mean, we've got half the world's population, as many as 4 billion people going to the polls this year. So it really is a bumper year for democracy in a lot of ways. And journalism's really important to my way of thinking in terms of supporting that. However, in terms of trust, we do have audiences who are less accepting of our reporting, shall we say, as credible or truthful for a range of reasons. And I think the onus is on us as a profession to fight really hard to bring people back on our side. And here, of course, I'm talking about credible newsrooms that subscribe to basic journalistic principles like independence and fairness and balance and minimizing harm. What to me, the only way that we can do that is transparency. The real challenge for us in a strange way as journalists now in this digital world that we have is to become human. We have to become human enough for people to understand that we're doing what we're doing not because of a particular agenda or because we want to hoodwink them or mislead them, but because we genuinely care passionately about democracy. I know I do. And I can tell you that all of my colleagues who I've worked with in newsrooms in South Africa are in exactly the same position. But we need to invite people into that process. We need to be transparent about how we do our journalism, how we corroborate facts, how we will identify mis- and disinformation, how we make our editorial decisions in terms of what we amplify and what we don't.
Camilla, I just wanted to find out, like, you know, a lot of professional jobs have got some sort of oversight committee or that kind of thing. When it comes to journalism, are there any checks and balances, or are we as the public, you know, just trying to figure this stuff out ourselves? And if we come across something that is blatantly false, perhaps go to take the journalist to court or that kind of thing? Or is there some sort of a body that makes sure that journalists adhere to the principles that you were talking about?
So the short answer is yes, there are bodies like that that exist in South Africa. The two most important ones are ICASA and the Broadcasting Complaints Commission of South Africa. And these two regulatory bodies, between them, we also have the Press Ombudsman. So I should probably talk about those three. So in terms of broadcasting, the Independent Communications Association of South Africa, ICASA, and the Broadcasting Complaints Commission of South Africa, the BCCSA, have oversight over broadcast media, and they are in a position to sanction, so to rule against and then punish broadcast media for transgressions. And then on the other side, you have the Press Ombudsman, who is also responsible for print complaints, if I can put it like that. And so we do have regulatory mechanisms in place, But the big thing to remember is that journalism, by and large, is actually a self-regulating profession. So we fight very hard, in fact, to remain as independent as possible and to not have, for instance, a government oversight. There's a lot of talk in South Africa about the Media Appeals Tribunal, which would be a government oversight body that would oversee the press in South Africa. And I'm not hugely well-versed in that, but there is concern around how that might affect our independence and the way we do our jobs. And so what really becomes incumbent on journalists and journalism is to self-regulate. So when we get it wrong, we apologize. If we don't apologize and one of the bodies that oversees us finds against us, we are forced to apologize. But by and large, we have to regulate ourselves.
So I thought this was an interesting point being made by Congo Chris in the comments. He says the problem in mainstream media is twofold. Firstly, you've got media houses who are increasingly political and narrative oriented, particularly hard left leaning. Secondly, there's conclusion shopping by the audience. I like that term, conclusion shopping, as in, you know, we like the answer that you'll get to at the end of this. We want to hear your reasoning so that we can argue better with our friends who disagree with us. But we're not really interested in the nuance.
Yes. And, you know, I think conclusion shopping potentially also goes to audience behavior in terms of hopping from channel to channel until they find a conclusion that they agree with, right? So, like, for every expert, you have an opinion, and for every opinion, you have an expert. And I think you talked earlier about echo chambers, Gareth, and I think people are programmed in terms of confirmation bias to seek out information that shores up their existing opinions, right?
Correct.
And audiences have this plethora of sources that they can go to find information that they already agree with and that shores up their opinion. I think, yeah, there's value in becoming more savvy information consumers. I think we all need a bit of media literacy almost in this new digital world in terms of how we assess sources, how we expose ourselves to information and how we counter our own biases. I mean, I think one of the important things that I often say to journalists I train, for instance, is we've got to be aware that we are all biased. We talk a lot about unbiased journalism, about objective journalism. These are fantastic North Stars for us, but they're never going to be achievable. Objectivity, to my mind, is a myth. I don't think one can be truly objective, and I don't think one can be truly unbiased. We all come with a set of biases, whether it's from how we were raised, the people we hang out with, where we went to school, whatever it might be. And I think it's really key to be aware of our own biases and to actively try to counter them, to expose ourselves to other opinions, to expose ourselves to information that we don't necessarily agree with, because it's almost to me part of responsible citizenry.
Okay, so one of the big examples we have, and you know, we thought that the machines and AI would be our savior in this respect. That you know, these things would give us finally the long awaited objectivity that we'd always been promised, and it turns out, I mean, especially in the light of a very embarrassing situation Google had to deal with last week when they launched their Gemini AI image generator, which showed to everybody, even people who were half asleep and didn't know what AI was, that even these AI algorithms and the coding that goes into them is hugely, heavily politically biased, and that the people who are programming the AI are as dangerous as if the AI itself were able to think purely in terms of one side of the political spectrum. It almost appears, and Google, of course, has the biggest database of information that anyone has ever had at their disposal. And yet this Gemini seems to have churned out such absolute nonsense that it's humiliated itself to the point where Google have had to withdraw the whole thing, apologize publicly. Whether or not they're going to actually change things is a whole different story. But actually going ahead with something that was bound to be such a disaster proves that the people, the Silicon Valley people who we all thought were going to be the smartest, the best, the ones who would lead the way for us, they're shown to be just as useless as the people in some backwater newsroom in a third world country.
Well, you know, I think the principle one has to keep in mind when it comes to artificial intelligence, and I've been sort of dipping my toe into these waters quite a lot in the last few years because, you know, I'm interested in how it's going to change journalism and how it manifests in journalism. But I think the real principle to remember when it comes to AI is this idea of garbage in, garbage out. An AI is only as trustworthy and as capable as the data that it's trained on, the information that it learns from. And the absolute fact is that the data and information that is available, particularly on the web, is hugely skewed towards a Western perspective and is affected by all of the biases that we see in everyday society. So if you have an AI that is trained on false data, you're going to have problems with that AI, like we saw with Gemini, like we saw, for instance, with Amazon a while back and their hiring policies. They trained an AI to sift through CVs to surface more likely candidates for them to hire. They thought it would be good. It would speed up their hiring processes, right? But very soon they realized that what this AI was doing was handing them overwhelmingly skewed white male candidates. Why? Because the AI was trained on the data of previous hires in Amazon. And the vast majority of those previous hires, surprise, surprise, had been white males. And so it learned to... The AI learned to prioritize factors that shouldn't have been there in the first place.
But that was true. That was true. I don't want them to give me a vision of how they'd like to see the future. I want them to give me what is true. I don't need some college graduate who studied Karl Marx to tell me how they think they'd like the world to look through their AI generator. I want them to show me what the world looks like. And that means if you put a picture of the founding fathers of the United States up, it's not going to be like some dude from Bengal and a guy from the Congo. These are not the founding fathers of the United States. That's just blatantly untrue. It's fantasy.
Yeah. Yeah. And so once again, one has to be aware of bias. And that to me is the key, is that we need to be aware that AI is as biased as the data it's trained on. And obviously we don't want it making up its own facts. We don't want it becoming political, if you will. We don't want it leaning left or right. We want it somewhere in the middle, but we've got to be aware that the historical data that it's trained on is going to perpetuate bias rather than fight against it.
But it's not the job of journalists to be fighting bias. It's the job of journalists to be reporting the truth.
Yes, so I was talking specifically about AI there.
And for AI. It's also it's AI's job to reflect some version of what is actually true, not to give us some fantasy.
But AI can only reflect what it's given. It's not conscious. It's not self-aware, right? It can't make a decision on what is true or not.
Well, it needs to look at what the information... Google, for example, has this incredible insight into everything on Earth. The great vast mass of human knowledge is available to Google in all of its forms. Video, pictures, audio, writing. Pretty much all of human knowledge is stored there. All that Google has to do is reflect, on balance, the very best of what human beings have achieved. For it to politicize with DEI, a kind of version of history that just isn't true, is not helping anybody. In fact, what it's doing is it's making all of us go, right, time to move away from Google.
Yeah, well, you know, I think, yeah, it's so difficult though, isn't it? Because when we say that that AI should reflect the best of humanity according to whom? Once again, we are flawed and biased entities. This is a bit of a philosophical debate, but to me it's a really interesting one that one doesn't always know where truth lies, and truth can mean different things to different people. And so one has to think very consciously, and again, I'm no AI expert, I'm interested in its applications in journalism and how we can potentially use it as a tool in the journalism belt. But I do think we need to be very aware of its inherent biases, and we need to be aware of the biases of those creating the AIs, and we need to be aware of the biases contained in the data that those AIs have access to.
You know, there's so many news outlets that we that are, you know, popular and some not so much. And how would you advise I guess the average Joe where to get their news from? As you guys were discussing a second ago about the impact of AI on journalism, like how does anyone find any level of truth in the middle of all of this information that's just flying around?
Oh, Jack, it's a great question. And, you know, I think again, I'm going to sound like a broken record here, but I think it's really important, first of all, as a first step, for us as media consumers to be aware of our own biases, yeah? So be aware that I like this kind of reporting or I like this kind of outlet for a certain reason. And you know, I think some of us are more or less aware of our biases, but it really is important to think through them carefully and at least be aware of where your own position is. What is the information that you are looking for? And then in some ways, I think it's really valuable to actively seek out outlets that will challenge your existing beliefs as well. So to me, what I look for when it comes to news organizations or journalists who I decide to engage with or whose content and opinions I value, I'm looking for firstly the facts. Yeah, I mean, it's almost easier to answer the counterfactual here in terms of what I look, what I don't look for, or what really pushes me away, right? So if I encounter a news organization or a journalist that has a scarcity of facts, I get really worried, yeah? So if it's more opinion and analysis rather than facts, I start to immediately question. If I get the sense that a news organization or a journalist is trying to make me feel a certain way rather than think something, again, big red flag for me. I start moving away. I look for people who use evidence to back up assertions, who include facts, and who leave me to make up my own mind. You know, it's the old principle of show, don't tell in journalism. Don't tell me how I should feel about something. Show me the evidence and let me make up my own mind for myself. So I steer, when I encounter problematic content, I automatically start steering away from those individuals or organizations, but I don't shield myself from credible organizations that don't happen to be reporting the set of facts that I agree with. I think it's really important to expose ourselves as well to opinions and ideas that we don't agree with so that we better understand our own positions.
So the tough question, and this is something that people ask me, and I'm in no position to offer advice because I don't know that I've got it right. But where do you get your news? Like, where do you... What are you, Camilla Barth, as somebody who, you know, you kind of have a greater part of the responsibility than most of us, because people will ask you this and expect you to be the person who knows the most, and you are, and that's why we're having you on this morning. Who do you listen to? Who do you pay attention to? Where do you get your news, and how do you ensure that you get that diversity of opinion as well as all the facts? Because again, these days, you know, even the facts are in dispute. We hear people saying, well, are those your facts or mine? Which is outrageous and ridiculous. Yeah. I mean, opinions are one thing, but you would think that we could at least come to terms on things like gravity pulls things down. You know, these are now controversial things.
I would hope.
where do you get your info?
You know, so I approach news gathering, I suppose, in a slightly different way because I'm a journalist myself. You know, so I'm not active on Twitter at all myself. Sorry, I should call it X. I really should. I'm not active on X at all myself. I don't feel the need to sort of throw my opinion out into the void whenever I feel like it. But I do find it an enormously useful tool for passing the news, because a lot of Twitter, a lot of X is journalists talking to other journalists. And a lot of it is politicians as well. And I have meticulously curated over the years a couple of lists on Twitter of people I respect, many of them people I know. You know, I'm also in the fortunate position that I know a lot of the journalists who are active in South Africa, and so, you know, I sort of have a read on in which ways they approach the news and in which ways they might be biased and in which ways that might sort of counteract my own bias, if you will. So I curate my information very carefully on X, in order to sort of take that that enormous fire hose for myself and get a little channel to sip. I suppose I'm also a huge fan of slow news rather than fast news, if I can put it like that. I like a perfectly baked loaf of news rather than a quickly fried pancake. So I go for a lot of the long form journalism. I find the Daily Maverick, for instance, a hugely useful resource in a lot of ways. It would be one of my go-tos for in terms of coverage. A lot of the outlets that I've worked with and for over the years as well, I suppose, in terms of broadcast, would be Newsroom Africa, Eyewitness News. I generally still have an affinity with those brands. In terms of journalists themselves, well, I mean, yeah, there are a ton of them. But I think people who I specifically respect in the news cycle at the moment, people like Ferial Haffagy, people like Tsidi Madia, Mandy Wiener, Stephen Curtis, they're all people who I've worked with as well, and who's thinking around the news I understand and respect. But that's, you know, a tiny drop in the ocean of the news that I do try to consume. I visit as many news websites as I can every day. I watch as many TV programs as I can. I consume international news as well as local, just to get a read on the whole picture rather than just a picture that suits me.
I think this is helpful. You know, I liked what you said about the counterfactual, and rather knowing what to look out for that you should not be paying attention to, because there are so many opinions about why you should listen to this one or that one. And I don't think that really helps too many people to figure out, because we also have limited time, right, Camilla? I mean, we can't be following 300,000 different news sources. Someone tipped me off a while ago, and I mentioned this in the first hour of the show to Jack. Someone tipped me off last year or the year before to an Indian news channel. It's not state-run, but it's one of a number of independent broadcasters in India. And I found that their coverage of things like Russia and the Ukraine was a lot more nuanced, interesting, thoughtful. They paid attention to a lot more detail than we seem to get in the West, or than Russia is trying to force down the throats of those people where they still have sway over the media. And I thought, what an interesting idea to go to India for news about Russia and the Ukraine. It seems almost like, you know, it's a counterintuitive way to behave. But it made sense to me once I saw it. And obviously all over the world there are examples of people like that. You don't want to go to MSNBC to see them covering Joe Biden in a positive light. You don't want to go to Fox to see them covering Ron DeSantis in a good light. But somewhere in between, you're going to find people who can make sense of this stuff.
Absolutely. And I think, again, it's really about opening up one's perspective and investigating what is out there. I love the idea or the example that you give of an Indian newsroom. And that's because it's operating from a totally different worldview, a totally different understanding of what the world is and how it functions. And I think, you know, there is a big divide between the West, or shall we call it the developed world, and the developing world. And I think, you know, so in some of the newsrooms that I've worked in, my argument as an editor has always been around what I call the Bangladesh test. So if something happens in the US, for instance, here in South Africa, the fact of the matter is that we are very quick to jump on it and report it Why? Because it's already being reported by CNN and the BBC and Fox and right? And we think, oh, well, we're going to be left behind if we don't pick up on what these major outlets are doing. But the question that I often ask my journalists in terms of whether we include it in our own coverage is, well, if this were happening in Bangladesh instead of the United States, would it make our news cycle? And if the answer is no, we need to think very critically about whether, in fact, we should be including that in our news cycle. So it is worth it opening oneself up to other opinions, to other ways of seeing the world, because the risk is that you get stuck in a Western paradigm, that you get stuck in one particular way of passing the news, and you're shutting yourself off from tons of valuable information and perspectives.
So, sorry about that. Camilla, I just wanted to ask, like, in 2024, a lot of things have changed from what we used to think of them. Once upon a time, propaganda meant the same thing to everyone. Nowadays, things have taken a bit more of a sophisticated turn. You know what I mean? Back in the day in the States, they spoke about ghettos, and then all of a sudden it was an urban area, as if white people didn't live in urban areas. But nonetheless, you get what I mean? Like the subtle changes in language have, you know, kind of made us look at language in a very different way. How do we identify propaganda these days? Because, I mean, one term to you could mean something completely different to me.
Absolutely. You know, it's such a, it's a great question, Jack. You know, I do a lot of training in so-called fake news, fact-checking and verification with journalists in Africa. And this is a big topic of debate among journalists as well as all of us here. And the blurring line here that we need to be aware of is the line between propaganda, misinformation, and disinformation. Yeah. Often couched in this terrible term that I absolutely hate, fake news. We all know it, and it's used very colloquially, but I just detest the term fake news because it's a misnomer.
Sorry, can we?
News is news. Yes.
So let's just define these things because it might be helpful for all of us. Absolutely. So, what is misinformation and what is disinformation?
Right. So the key thing to remember about the difference between mis and disinformation is intent. It all comes down to whether someone intends to do harm with false information or not, because mis and disinformation both fall under the umbrella of false information. Yeah. So not news, not facts, false information. And mis and disinformation are different in that misinformation is all around people who are spreading fake information or false information without any intent to cause harm. So, for instance, I mean, we've all got these WhatsApps from our elderly aunt who warning of a tornado heading to our area, right? Our dear aunt is not sending that on because she wants to mislead us. She's not sending it to us because she wants us to act on false information. She's sending it because she's received it. Perhaps she hasn't done the work to verify it herself, but she wants to share it with us just in case it's true so that we stay safe. Yeah, that's an example of misinformation. Information that is false but is not shared with the intent to cause harm. Disinformation is the ugly sort of brother or sister to that, that is false information that is knowingly shared with the intent to do harm. And that harm might be to provoke strong emotions in people and get a certain reaction to incite violence, for instance. The harm might also be just getting them to question widely accepted facts. So spread confusion. So some kind of confusion. So we need to be aware of the difference between those and ensure that we understand what mis and disinformation are and why they're so dangerous, because misinformation spread without any intent to cause harm is every bit as dangerous as disinformation, even though
what do we do with the people who do this? Because if it's your aunt, you don't want her arrested for spreading you know, false information around. And there were a lot of people during COVID, and every time there's anything that happens in the news, there's someone who sends some horrifying, frightening advisory out. You're like, SOS, and everybody ducks under their beds. But we don't want these people to go to jail. They might be well-meaning. And then we see examples of how people are actually trying to influence elections. Let's get back to elections for a second. Yeah. They try to influence elections positively or negatively by spreading nonsense around about, you know, the number of people at a rally or a riot that's going on somewhere where it actually isn't. And we saw, even with the riots here in South Africa, we saw people spreading, you know, news about this is going on in Midrand. It turns out there was nothing going on. This is going on in KZN. It turns out there was stuff going on. This stuff can lead to actual harm, as opposed to making someone feel bad. Where do you draw the line?
So, I mean, I think when it comes to misinformation being spread by ordinary people, just like you and I, right? There's an enormous amount of research going on in this sphere at the moment. And the best available answer in terms of how to counter that seems to be to not take these people on in public forums. So, for instance, if your aunt posts this warning in a big family WhatsApp group with 30 people in it, taking her to task for posting that in that WhatsApp group is a very dangerous thing to do, in a way. It's a difficult thing to do because your aunt is immediately going to get defensive because it's happening in front of other people. The best way to counter this kind of thing seems to be to reach out in private, on a private platform, and speak to the person concerned and equip them with the facts. If you have the facts to counter their opinion or their misinformation, equip them with those facts, because very often you'll see people immediately climb down and apologize of their own volition. Not if we try to force them, because then they become defensive. But often if we just say to them, this is actually not the case. And I've done this tons of times, by the way. I'm on a couple of WhatsApp groups that have hundreds of people on them. And I can't help myself when I see misinformation being spread. I used to always jump back onto that group and call it out on the group, thinking, well, I've got to tell as many people as possible about this. But it always led to a shutdown. And I found it far more valuable, for instance, to message them on the side, just DM them quickly and say, look, thanks for sharing this, but here's what's going on actually, and you might want to consider this. And very often that would then lead to them of their own volition countering the misinformation that they have spread. When it comes to bad actors, shall we call them, so people who are spreading disinformation and doing it intentionally, well, then I think we're seeing increased legislation around how to deal with these bad actors developing around the world. And I think it needs to get harsher. And I think the consequences need to be clear, that if you actively try to mislead people or harm them in some way, that there must be consequences and you must be held to account.
So, Camilla, according to you, what does the future of journalism look like? I mean, recently, Fox News got into a lot of trouble about the 2020 elections, saying that I think they came out and said that the election was stolen and they were taken to court as a result, and they lost the case recently. And including the fact that a lot of people have become a bit disillusioned with especially big media companies, where, you know, we don't always just trust when they say something. I mean, back in the day, we had three channels, and we just trusted that what was said in the bulletin would be true, or whenever you'd pick up a newspaper like Sowetan or City Press or whatever it might be, whatever it is that you were reading, you would immediately assume that it was true. But over the years, the veil has kind of been removed from our eyes, and we've seen just how muddled media can be when it comes to their alliance with the truth and their alliance with their money interests. What does the future of journalism look like?
Yeah, so, Jack, I think When we look, I mean, I can gaze into my crystal ball. Sure. I'm not sure that I've got all the answers, but there are certain things that we're seeing that I think are valuable to keep in mind. Number one is a pulling away from mass media. So there's a big discussion going on in the media fraternity at the moment globally around people's pulling away from mass media and their interest more and more in local media. And I do wonder whether we're going to see the reemergence of local media, which we know has been dying off for the last 20 or 30 years. I hope in a way that we see hyper-local media coming back. I think one of the big things that we've lost as the media and as newsrooms is a connection with our audiences, a real connection with them. We had that for so long in many of the newsrooms that I've worked in, but that seems to be failing now. And I think in order for journalism to really function properly, we need to be deeply committed to, embedded in, and connected with our audiences. And we can't do that if we're trying to cater to everyone all the time. And so I do wonder if the future of journalism is a more localized and perhaps a hyper-localized newsroom that reports on a specific community. I do also think that, and we're seeing it already, we're shifting more into a curation role. We are curators of news. We are amplifiers of news rather than the originators of news, right? It breaks on X before it breaks anywhere else. We are no longer the gatekeepers of facts and media. But I do think that we are now in a position where we need to increasingly amplify valuable voices and underheard voices, and we need to curate the news for people and make it digestible and easy for them to understand it. And again, it's about very consciously thinking about how we serve our audiences. So I'll take it back to where we started. You know, I think journalists exist to cater to their audiences. They exist to be advocates for their audiences, and journalism exists to help people make better decisions in their lives. And I think perhaps that this re-emergence of local news is an answer. I don't know about the answer, but it seems to be a plausible answer.
Well, I saw a story in the news about Facebook and Instagram owner Meta that has said that they'll form a team to tackle deceptive AI in upcoming EU elections in June. It's concerned by how generative AI, which can create fake videos, images, and audio, might be used to trick voters. And that's a whole other thing. When you talk about fake news, how about just this complete deep fake situation we've got where you see someone who you do trust, someone who you think you know, and they're telling you that you've got to buy this crypto coin or something, and you know it's complete nonsense. Now, those people could easily, those people who are doing this stuff, could easily turn their nefarious skills to, you know, having someone who people respect and love endorse something truly horrible in politics.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're already seeing it in South Africa, by the way. I worked for a long time with a journalist called Francis Hurd. And Francis, if anyone watches the SABC, is a well-known anchor on the SABC. And she was essentially cloned. Someone used an AI to create an avatar of her and was able, because of the amount of footage that's publicly available of her, to perfectly clone her face and her voice and get her to endorse products that Francis, I don't think having known her, would ever endorse, for instance. We are already seeing this kind of sophisticated technology in South Africa and being weaponized in South Africa. And AI is going to be a big differentiator in a lot of the elections that we're going to see around the world this year. It is quite terrifying in some ways. And the problem is that we don't actually have the tools yet to properly counter this kind of thing. So you do have some AI programs that can detect AI created elsewhere. Gemini, for instance, for all its failings, does seem to be able to detect if a video has been made with Sora, which is OpenAI's new generative video program, which is startling if you watch it. So we do have this almost cat and mouse game where we have a sophisticated AI able to create deep fakes. They are a reality and we need to be very aware of them. And then you have another AI playing catch up that might be able to detect these. But yeah. It's a cat and mouse game at the moment.
Yeah, it's a rock and a hard place. I believe Denzel Washington said it best that if you read the news, you are misinformed. If you don't read the news, you are uninformed. It's such a weird thing to navigate. It's weird. It is so weird.
That. Yeah, you choose your poison. Which would you prefer to be? mm-hmm.
It almost makes a case for the blissfully ignorant to keep their heads in the sand. But I'm glad that you were able to help us wade through some of this very, very difficult material, because it is hard for most of us to understand. And I think maybe I'm cautiously optimistic that we'll figure out a way of discerning in more direct and less labor-intensive ways what is true and what is not. But journalists have played their part in the past. The Fourth Estate is important. We want people to be able to challenge power, to be able to report honestly about what's going on and not to be influenced by the money and power of so many in society who wish to fill our daily feed with nonsense and with narrative. So I thank you, Camilla. It's really good to have someone who is informed and helpful on this matter. And I hope we'll talk to you again soon.
Wonderful. Thank you so much, Jack and Gareth, for having me. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thanks,
Camilla. Pass, everybody. Very, very cool. And we will be back tomorrow at 6 a.m. for our special interview. You can check out that and a whole lot more on cliffcentral.com. Also, don't forget, if you haven't seen it already, to go and watch the Podcast Party special, Democracy Unplugged. You can find it on YouTube at Podcast Party SA. That's featuring Mighty Jamie, featuring Penwell the Black Pen, and Sizwe Mpofu Walsh, and our moderator, Jack Mutlante, who is on your screen right now. Check that out and a whole lot more. We will see you tomorrow. Cheers, everybody. Bye-bye.
Cheers.
CliffCentral.com.